I'm going to start off by welcoming you to this newest version of the NCMC podcast series. And today we're talking to Lynn Lovell, who is a longtime bass teacher at the Community Music Center. And I'm going to start out just asking you what first attracted you to the bass when you started playing.
I'm Lynn Lovell, and I got interested in the bass. It wasn't that I had the interest, but my orchestra conductor, and when I moved from Canada to outside of New York, you know, they probably wanted a bass player in the orchestra. But my mother had said, go to my sister and I to go down and sign up for an instrument. I really didn't know what I wanted to. I think I might have mumbled something about low string or cello or something. And, you know, I never forget Mr. Silichek tapped me on my shoulder and he said, how about the double bass? I said, sure. And I was 13. Uh-huh. And he was a really a pioneer. This is just outside the city. But back in those days, women weren't playing bass. Well, he had four girls playing the bass. Not the same bass, of course.
Well, that's pretty impressive.
So that's how it started, and I never left.
That's great. So
he knew I was a bass player because I can tell now. I can meet people, you know, and I just end up sitting next to a bass player wherever I am. Uh-huh. And I just, it's a vibe. You just know they really like the low instrument.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Do you play any other instruments?
Not okay. Really. Uh-huh. I mean, I studied piano and, you know, some recorder. I used to play some recorder with my dad and my uh-huh. sister.
Right.
But other than that, oh, actually, no. There's a brief period where I tried an alto sax.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't know much about embouchure. And I was playing out of tune all the time. So that was the end of that.
Right. Well, it's pretty easy to play out of tune on the bass too, I guess. But
well, that is very true, as you well know.
So you played bass all the way through high school?
Yes.
And yep. Did you know that you wanted to be a professional bass player when you graduated?
Oh, God, no. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Uh-huh. I had no clue. But I became a professional because I played bass, and everyone always needs bass players, and we're the most working musicians around. We get all the gigs because there's never enough bass players. So I backed into the career.
Uh-huh.
One day I said, oh my gosh, you know, this is a constant thing. It must be a career.
So when was your first gig?
In high school, I uh-huh. got called out from high school performances to do shows, a lot of shows, you know, through high school. And then
like Broadway shows in the pit orchestra.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Pit orchestra. Right. And there was the community. So I got into those, and then I played in a community symphony, and gigs just, you know, spun off of those, you know, uh-huh. I'll come play with this group or that. And there was, you know, a little money involved. And
do you remember the first time you got paid for a gig?
No, I don't.
Well, that's all right.
That's not saying much, Joe.
Well, you probably didn't get paid much for your first gig either.
No, but you know, anything to be paid right. for your first gig, that, you know, that would be really something. But
right.
I just don't remember.
What was the first band that you played with? What kind, other than a pit orchestra, like in a smaller group?
Wow, let's see now. It would probably be, yes, when I was playing in one of our local orchestras here up in Massachusetts, a sax player came up to me and asked me if I'd like to play in his band. But I, you know, he wanted me to play electric bass, and I didn't have one. So uh-huh. Go buy one and come up and join our band. It was a quartet. It was general business, you know, they played for dance music up at the Whale Inn in Goshen,
uh-huh.
the Paul Driscoll Quartet.
Oh, yep. Right. I remember Paul.
So, yep. And we had another singer. And then when she moved on, I got Giselle in there, Giselle uh-huh. Italian.
Right.
So she and I worked together with Paul, and Eddie L. I can't remember his last name now, but we worked together until Whale Inn closed. So that was probably about 13 years, 11 or 13 years. And then the band right after that was the Wholesale Klezmer Band. And I was with them 14 years. And we played President Clinton's second inauguration in Washington.
Right. I remember hearing that was, I think Brian told me the mouthpiece stuck to his lips. It was so cold that day. Must have been difficult to play.
Oh, it was 36 degrees. And I had the flu. So I was all bundled up. Uh-huh. And we were outside on a street corner with the parade right going by us, you know.
Right.
And that was a tough, it was tough for everybody, you know, especially the wind players, because, you know, they're huffing and puffing and the clarinet's flat and the accordion sharp, and you can't tune an accordion. And,
right.
You know, it wasn't our best gig, let's say. But
was it your most prestigious gig that you ever played?
Well, it's close rival to Carnegie Hall. I would say that was took the trump.
Okay. Playing Carnegie Hall had to have been very special. So tell me a little bit about that gig.
Well, that was again with the Wholesale Klezmer Band. And I kind of wondered how we ended up there. But Pete Seeger, we had played for him on the Hudson River. And he knew of our band. And when he was putting together the 100th anniversary of Carnegie Hall's history, he pulled together the folk part of it. There was a jazz one, a classical one, and a folk grouping. So we were on stage with people like Tommy Makem and Sweet Honey and the Rock and Simone Shaheen and this wonderful little Italian group, you know. He managed to find really authentic sounding groups, you know, or real historical groups, you know. So we were tagged as the Klezmer group,
right?
And that was really, really something, really something. And we just did our bit, you know, a little out of tune and a little umshababa. I know that's not a real word, but it sounds appropriate.
Yes, it does. Well, how long was your set? Do you remember?
I don't even know. Maybe we had three or four songs because we had all those other people to play, you know?
Right.
I'd never heard of before, but it was a nice concert. And I just remember, you know, smiling at the people and looking at the audience and then realizing, wait a minute.
There's Carnegie
four
Hall
balconies. And you have to look up.
Right.
You have to look up. So that was quite a realization.
Well, it must have been nice very place. Exciting. So
very exciting.
I know that musicians generally have a tough time making a living. Actually, in the klezmer world, I think, or in the Yiddish world, the worst thing that a daughter could say to her mother is, "Mom, I fell in love with a musician." And I wonder if you'd talk for a minute or two about how it was making a living through all this time.
Right. Well, it wasn't easy. And I think the kind of person that would do well in this kind of thing is a juggler, because you really have to have skills in many different avenues, and that you are very good at juggling your time and organizing your time well, because, you know, you might be able to work in, well, of course, then the lessons came in the 80s. Somebody asked me, well, how do you do that? You know, how do you make sounds on that? So it launched my teaching career. And that was an instant career because there weren't many bass teachers around. And that was in this area. And I just fell to that, like, you know, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do, is teach. So I really like that. And so there, you round your lessons, I would schedule various other things, like working in somebody's yard or small little, you know, part-time jobs. And then that sort of gravitated towards my interest in animals. And so I became a pet sitter, and I could organize my times around my gigs and lessons. So there was that. And then the other part of that, which is very interesting, because I look back and I thought, how did I end up with that? But, you know, here we are. Uh-huh. And that was instruments themselves. There weren't very many basses around, never mind bass players, when I started working at your store, upright bass players that could specialize in classical and jazz. So I thought it would be wise. Like, I don't know. One of my students said, you know, I tried this instrument out and it's really lovely, but I have a problem with my hand and I just can't continue. But you know, Joe, I really liked her bass. And I said, well, gee, would you consider selling it to me? She said, yes. So I bought her bass and I had been struggling because I just had these little part-time jobs. Oh yeah, I worked in a photo mat. Remember those little kiosks on the parking lots for a short while, and you know, all kinds of odd things.
So that was a full or three-quarter bass, probably.
Three-quarter bass, yeah. And then I started buying other basses up, you know, because shortly after that, I had a student come, I'd love to learn the upright bass, but I don't have one. So I started renting the bass, and then I got another bass and I rented that one out, and so on and so on. Well, I now have 25 basses.
Oh my goodness. That's quite
They're
a
like breeding like rabbits in the basement. It's a, you know, I've got little tiny ones and.
Right. How long before you got your first fractional size, kid size bass?
Oh, several years, because I didn't even know they were out there really. Uh-huh. And then somebody told me about this 10th size, and then I got an 8th size, several quarter sizes and some half sizes and 5/8. And now I'm starting to unload a little bit, you know, so I do have some that can be still available. It's hard to let them go. They become friends, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, that's very interesting. That's probably unusual for a teacher to get into the rental business. But I know a lot of music store owners started out teaching. Talking about students, who was Marty Jaffe the best student that you ever had?
Yes, I would say so. Marty started with me at 6.5 years old. I happen to be his godmother. And when he was a little tiny kid, you know, just waddling around, and he'd visit, he would waddle up to my electric bass in the stand, and he'd put his hands on it like a double bass, you know. And so, you know, I encouraged him. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but he gravitated to it by himself. And when his mom, when he was ready, 6 or so, and I had that 10th size bass, his mom asked him what instrument he would like to play. And he said, I think I'd like to try the bass. And the rest is history.
Right. Did you know right away that he was exceptional?
Yes. You could kind of tell, because his big problem was he didn't play it perfectly. When I put the page up to introduce a new piece of music, or, you know, he's 6 years old, I mean.
Right.
And then you put up some little tune, a Suzuki type of thing or something. And he'd get all upset that he didn't play it perfectly, first off. Uh-huh. And I had my whole teaching experience with Marty was more about teaching him patience with himself and to really study the piece, and that's not how it works. You know, you have to work on the piece and then it sounds good.
A lot of most people think when they see a musician who's really good, oh, he's so talented. But actually, even in the case of a super talented kid, it's still, you got to practice a lot to get good.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yep. And it's just a whole different mindset for how to set that up and how to, you know, have a structure when, especially if the student is young. It's all about self-motivation and application and a steadiness to it, you know, and keeping themselves going. And it teaches them a lot of self-discipline, which is very handy, as we know, in adult life.
So did you have a, what was the worst student you ever, do you remember like a student that was just a nightmare?
I'd love to say, gosh, there were so many, but you know, I really can't remember anybody really standing out. But I can give you a type of student that was very difficult. And there was times where I kind of, you know, as they were struggling along, I'd actually, you know, have to wake myself up. I found myself kind of falling asleep in the middle of that. Maybe it was just me. I was just overtired. I don't know. But it seemed like in his lesson, I seemed to want to fall asleep. Anyway, that's sort of embarrassing to say that because it's very unusual. And I love the work. And I really try very hard to lock into the person and in read how their mind goes and in learning this instrument. You know, it's the same instrument, but everyone learns it a little bit differently. And you have to really be in touch with the student, no matter what age,
right?
And make it so that it's comfortable and it's not too hard and, you know, not too hard and not too soft. It's sort of a Goldilocks approach and make it really workable for them to enjoy. It's hard to really enjoy playing bass because the problem there is we're an accompanying instrument. We're not a melody instrument.
Right.
And of course, when you're learning, you do play melodies, but in the real world, you're playing these funny lines that don't make any sometimes musical sense.
Right.
Especially if you're playing some classical like Schoenberg or something.
Right.
And like, you know, I get mad at composers because, you know, and I've actually thrown down my bow in a rehearsal because I was so angry with that particular piece written by that particular artist I just mentioned, the composer. And I just, you know, he didn't write good bass lines. I'm sorry. It just really was bad. So, once you learn the instrument and you can start to understand how the bass supports the entire orchestra or band, we are the foundation and we're the core of the whole, whatever, whoever you're playing with, we're the most powerful in the band. That is cool. Now there's where the excitement comes in.
Right.
Because you know that if you hit that low C and the whole floor is rumbling and that's coming up through the violin player's feet and you know, and even the French horns can feel that low rumble. Well, I mean, elephants, step aside. Here come the bass players. That is the biggest thrill for me now after 60 years of doing this.
Yeah. So which composer writes the best bass lines?
Oh, Beethoven's very good. He knew what to do. There are a lot of them, but you know, I like to.
So I want to talk to you about just, you know, you've had a very long career and you must have played thousands of gigs. And
I have two boxes of programs, two full, and that's with all the ads taken out. I spent a lot of time getting rid of all the ads in my programs. No, maybe it's two and a half boxes since high school.
What's the farthest from home you ever went to do a gig? Where was it?
Let's see. We did. Oh, of course, British Columbia.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was with the Gypsy Wranglers. That was the third long-term band. That's going on 26 years, maybe more.
Uh-huh.
I've lost track. Gypsy Wranglers. We played at the Black Sheep Deli every week in Amherst. And it looks like they're going to be opening back up. And we've been invited to stay on. So I'm thrilled about that, you know.
Yep. So how did you get to British Columbia? That's a long way.
At the time we had an accordion player in the band and we went on the invitation, you know, it was an accordion festival in Kimberley, British Columbia. So we went for that and the whole band flew out and I had to borrow or rent a bass out there, and it was terrible. The action was so high, I almost died. But you know, such is the business. And then we got another gig in a club in Calgary during the Stampede, and that was during that same tour. And boy, we had such fun. I mean, we were whitewater rafting as a band, and oh, it was just greatest fun. So that was the farthest place, but the next farthest was Montmagny, Quebec. And we played the accordion festival there. And oh boy, that was fabulous. So we've and lots of weddings that were New York City at the Plaza Hotel and, you know, different places like that. You know, Joe, they actually served us ham sandwiches at a big Jewish wedding.
I believe it. I played Jewish wedding where they had pigs in blankets. That was...
Oh, my God. I know. It's so rude.
Yeah. So what was the best food you ever had at a gig? Do you remember?
Oh, well, it was definitely in the Jewish weddings.
Right.
The kugel and the... You know, mission. What I can't. It's not rolling off my tongue anymore because I haven't eaten in days. it was always at the weddings. Great food, and I kind of ended up in feeling like I was. When's the food? It was my first question. And, you know, I'm doing the gigs for the food because I was working so much. It was probably a little too much. But I say no.
No, you can't say no.
Musicians, you just can't really pick and choose because you just thought that when's your next, you had rent to pay and, car insurance, car, all that stuff. And I was always terrified that I would never be able to, you know, and I raised my two girls myself and, you know, and just how, so once a year, it was when I made it all the way through September and I had made it yet another year. So I'm like, oh, okay, well, let's go for the next one and the next one. So it's just been hit or miss. And I just really, really have been very lucky with the amount of gigs. And, you know, I'm semi-retired, especially after last year. You know, I'm okay. Oh, my God.
What was the most challenging gig that you ever had? You had to work the hardest and...
Ooh. Well, nothing stands out as the most hardest, but it's hard, especially when you're in a small ensemble for a classical piece that's very, very perfected, very good group, and you're the only bass player. There have been a number of those through the colleges and the small... professional groups in Vermont and Massachusetts that really have put me on the spot. Oh, there was one that just came to mind. I was asked to play or sub or something out in Westport or someplace halfway to Boston at a country club for Uncle Abe, whoever he was. It was some birthday party. So I got out there and they had a white piano in this fancy, fancy place. And there was a slight rehearsal. I had to go to Boston for the rehearsal. And I noticed that the young people that were around me in this little orchestra, it was sort of a pops orchestra, were awfully good, awfully good. Oh, man, you know, they were doing all this William Tell stuff, you know. And yeah, that was the main, one of the main pieces on this program. And I found out like after the show that we did with this birthday party, that it was the Boston Pops.
Wow. So you played with the Boston Pops.
But I had no idea they were the Boston Pops.
Right.
Well, and it was when I was setting up, the piano player was just playing some little pop, you know, not pop music, but, you know, background music. And I knew the tunes. And so I just started naturally just sort of trying to tune up the bass, but, you know, I was really just playing along with him. He said, oh, yes, play along, you know, and I had no charts, but I was just doing it by ear, you know, a little jazzy kind of from the Wailin' kind of music. And you know, then afterwards I'm driving home and I think I flew home. I don't remember the wheels on the pavement. I was home in like 15 minutes from the middle. And how did I get home? I was so excited, you know.
How did you get the gig? I'm sure they have a regular bass player.
I have no idea.
Well, I was going to ask you what the most famous person you've ever played with, but that probably being with the Boston Pops was the most most famous.
Yeah.
Is there one time when you feel like the gig was the most important thing that you've ever done as a musician, when you really made a difference?
Wow. And nothing stands out as at the moment. You know, I showed up and I was there. And if I hadn't been there, it would have been a real mess. So, you know, I would say because of the importance of the instrument, you know, your part is hugely and hugely vital. Almost every gig is the most important one, unless there are other players with you that can cover if you miss some notes or something. Oh, so Joe, I wanted to say that, yes, there is one thing that makes it the most exciting thing is that when we had the Western New England Double Bass Society.
Oh, right. I meant to ask you about that, and I totally forgot.
So, yes, and I...
So briefly tell me about tell me about what happened with the New England Bass Society and the big show that we did.
Oh, it was a fabulous show. We were at the Academy of Music, February 27th, 2000. And it took me 4 months to get the parts and all the players together from all my students from, I guess the youngest was 8 or 9 years old, up to white-haired people, which we know all about that now, and everything in between. And some were professional, and we played pieces, everything from Bartok to bebop to just all kinds of different musics, pieces.
We played When the Bass Players Take Over the World, and I think Lynn Hardy and Diane Sanabria sang with us.
That's right. And it was really a fun show. And my memory, I still have a picture around here of all the basses were lined up between Memorial Hall and the Academy of Music on that day without their cases on in February.
We're lucky it wasn't snowing.
Yes. And that it was bad weather. It wasn't. It was, you know, doable until we could file into the backstage. And it's very tight back there. You know, to get from the stage door onto the stage. And we had to do it during intermission because it was so many basses. We had 40 bass players on stage at one time, a record number after 5 years of little concerts and bigger concerts were 46 basses, you know. And how I came up with that idea was the ISB, the International Society of Bassists, in 1990, I think it was. It was in New York City, the convention. Well, there was like thousands of bass players come out of nowhere. And of course, in New York, every bass player came to the convention and stopped by. And they had...
was in the subway, right? Didn't you go into the subway?
Yes, we went into the subway and we played the A-Train, what else? And that's then great. We got into Washington Square and to the Lincoln Center. That's what we did. Washington Square, got the A-Train, went up to Lincoln Center, played a repeat of the concert. It was Milt Hinton's 80th birthday.
Wow.
So we were doing a tribute to him. He was with us playing along. And we had all these little tiny pieces were randomly passed out from, you know, like the bass show. And we did this little crazy concert with all these kooky bass. But, you know, it's just something you don't see every day. So that's, you know, somebody had asked me for a prop for something four Sundays in February. And they wanted to use some of my basses for props, which that skit didn't pan out. But I said, Hey, wait a minute. We should put the basses on there. So that's how that came about.
Well, I think we'll wrap this up. So Lynn, this was really fun talking to you about life of a musician. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, and, this is really fun. The questions I hadn't thought of, and I just wonder I came up with some answers.
Right.
And thank you so much for inviting me, Joe.
It was a pleasure.
And everybody at NCMC. It's a great organization. Very proud to be a member.